Welcome to Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine's Fiction Podcast. I'm EQMM's editor, Janet Hutchings. This month's selection is an entry from our Department of First Stories. It's by a former prosecutor whose first nonfiction book, Painkiller, Catching New York's Deadliest Doctor, a memoir of a real case investigation and trial, is due out from Simon & Schuster in just a couple of months. In her fiction, the New York author likes to explore morally ambiguous characters, and her debut tale for EQMM contains a memorable example of the subtle shadings of culpability. Here is Cecilia Fulton reading her story, The Father of the Corpse, from the January-February 2019 issue of EQMM.
It took me a while to make the connection. He's just not a guy you would recognize easily. Probably because you wouldn't really be drawn to him in the first place. He looks like a crumpled paper bag. The rough texture of his skin blurs his features, so you can't really register what his eyes look like or what color they are or the size of his nose or the length of his eyebrows. Also, I'd only ever seen him looking grim in washed-out dark suits, so at first, this guy in the cream-colored suit with a big smile on his face, I had no idea who he was, except that he was familiar in some way. I probably wouldn't have noticed him at all, except it was snowing heavily outside, and it seemed brazen for a man to wear ivory on a snowy day, especially, as I noticed, with Yeti-sized snow boots that were still as wet as a soaked dog. Fascinating, I thought. I agonized for hours over my outfit. In fact, I'm still agonizing over it. And here's this guy, chatting up the bride's mother with total insouciance, seemingly unburdened by any second-guessing over whether appropriate textiles, season-appropriate hues, or the need to take off the dripping fur appendages before launching himself into a fancy party. How had he even gotten so far into posh Waveney Castle, past the coat check and into the mingling rooms with Connecticut royalty, without changing out of those boots? It was only as I saw the guy lean in and speak right into the proud mother's ear, getting up on his toes to get a bit of height, then bending a little to angle his words right into the ear canal, that I realized, hey, I know him. I'd seen him talk to people that way before. At work. It was someone from work. And then it came to me. I knew him from court. Actually, yes, that was it. I'd watched him talk to defendants that way. Up on his tiptoes, then bending in and leaning toward the ear and whispering in that targeted manner to make sure no one else could hear his wise counsel. With that came the name. I poked my husband. I know that guy, I told him. It's Fred. Fred Krantz. Hey, Matt, honey, look, I know this guy. It's a defense attorney from work, Fred Krantz. Matt followed my lead and took a quick look, but then turned his attention back to the passing hors d'oeuvres. Oh, really? That's great, he said. Matt couldn't understand. Fred was my salvation. It was Matt's second cousin's wedding, and I was all out of juice. It's one thing to invest yourself in social conversation with first-degree marital relations, knowing you're building a long-term relationship, but we weren't expecting to see many of these people again. Some would die soon. Some lived too far away to be seen again. And the rest were just, well, not my kind of people. Let's just say that as a prosecutor specializing in prescription drug trafficking, I wasn't thrilled to be the guest of a family whose wealth was directly related to the sales of highly addictive pharmaceutical substances. I'd started thinking about how many pills the bride's father must have sold to pay for each artisanal pig in a blanket, but concluded that my abstinence from the hors d'oeuvres would hardly be an effective protest. Besides, no one ever really cared until it touched their own family. We figured that guests who were just arriving would feel the need to find the bride and groom's parents as soon as possible and would accordingly keep any intervening conversations short. As a result, we had positioned ourselves strategically near the door to get all of our obligatory greetings out of the way, and grab hors d'oeuvres from the welcoming waiters at the same time. It was a smart move. The guests fumbled through the coat check, dusted snow off their hair, and ran right into us. If we didn't know them, we smiled politely and let them pass. But with the ones we knew, we launched right in. All I had to do was shake hands, kiss kiss, smile big, confirm the information they'd received about me, and count down 30 seconds until they'd start looking for their next target. Yes, I'm pregnant. We're so excited. Yes, I'm due very soon, but hopefully not tonight. Ha ha ha. Yes, winter pregnancies are such a pain. I couldn't even put on my boots without help this morning. Yes, isn't this place stunning? The view from the hill must be just beautiful when it's not snowing. Yes, lunchtime weddings are so original. So original. So creative. Yes, I work at the district attorney's office. It's interesting, but also exhausting. Yes, I plan to keep working after I give birth. Oh, yes, of course. Please go ahead. The bride's parents are just over there. We'll talk to you later. Absolutely. Boom. Done. Next. I was prepared for it all, from the questions about my labor and delivery plans to the eyes darting away in search of a better option. And I was bored as hell. Fred Krantz wasn't a friend, by any stretch, nor was he even a casual acquaintance. But he and I had topics to discuss other than my stretch marks. I'm going to go say hi, okay? I said to Matt, placing my hand on his arm. He smiled, nodded, and reached for a mini Provençal quiche. I steered my heavy body around to approach Fred. The bride's mother was moving away from him with a laugh, her hand still outstretched toward him, although she was already locking eyes with another guest. Fred stood alone for a moment, stroking his face with a distant look in his eye and one corner of his mouth upturned, admiring his last comment or thinking of his next conversation. Wondering whether he should now shed the snow boots? Enjoying the weight of the wet fur around his feet and counting snowflakes in the distance? Thinking of his clients, who might not even be able to see the snow through the secured windows of their cells? I interrupted his reverie. Mr. Krantz, hello. Hello. We shook hands. His palm was dry and his hold on my hand was neutral. Clearly, I had not sparked any lights in the Krantz memory bank. Lise Acorn from the Manhattan DA's office. We've had cases together. His mouth became an O, and his eyebrows lifted, creating waves of wrinkles on his forehead. Of course, ADA Acorn. What a surprise. So, who do you know? My husband, I gestured. Matt Barrett. Janie is his cousin. Second cousin. Matt's mother and Jack are first cousins. Great. Great. My wife. She's close friends with the mother. Very close. Known her for years. Would he consent to a chat about work, the war on drugs, the challenges of his job? I wasn't sure he was interested. His eyes checked the room as we paused. He was done talking before we had begun. He must be disappointed to see me, I realized. He must have been so happy to engage in conversation outside of a cell, with people who didn't remind him of his sordid clients. This wedding was an escape for him, just as he had appeared to be an escape for me. So I was the last person he'd be interested in chatting up. Well, might be for the best. You never know what could come up. I opened my mouth to say something polite and close out the encounter. His eyes locked back onto mine. Wait a minute. He wagged his finger in the air, as if to conjure up information. There was that article about you. Oh? I decided to wait so that I wouldn't look too eager to hear the rest. I lifted my eyebrows to signal that I was listening. He pointed his finger toward me. In the law journal. Didn't you get some award? Are you one of those people who read the entire law journal because it was really buried in there? Fred shrugged. Paper copy, every day, all the way. What can I say? I'm old-fashioned. So, congratulations. Thank you. You have to wonder with those kind of awards, you know, the best under 40 category. I mean, will I still be special when I'm over 40? Fred looked at me with a squint. I don't follow. He wasn't in the mood for my musings. I reached out and patted his arm. I'm not making sense, sorry. Must be the hormones. Anyway, thank you. It was an interesting article, actually. What you said about your work? I couldn't remember what I'd said about my work. There was a silence. Well, he said, turning abruptly, good seeing you. Enjoy. See you inside. We were already inside, I could have clarified, but I couldn't hold this slippery fish. Maybe he meant inside the ceremony room? I waved and returned to my husband's side, where a lively chat was underway. Jack Normand, the bride's father, had gotten caught in a familial cluster, and everyone was giving their all. Thank you, he was saying to my in-laws, turning smoothly on the heels of his perfect caramel-colored leather shoes to gather well wishes and bestow elegant smiles. Matt turned to me and whispered, Jack's company's new drug was approved by the FDA. It's great news, apparently. Funny topic to be discussing at his daughter's wedding, I thought, but we all knew we had big pharma profit margins to thank for the venue, the food, and most likely the groom's interest in the bride. Though it was possible that given how much the bride loved pills and how many of them she consumed on a regular basis, she was as much responsible for the company's success as her executive-level father. Matt's mother swooped to my side and propelled me toward Jack. "Actually, Jack, this is our daughter-in-law, Liz. She's a DA in New York." "Just an ADA, actually, meaning an assistant district attorney," I clarified. Not that I run the risk of being confused with the famous older white male who currently serves as the elected district attorney of Manhattan, but inaccuracy kills me. "Yes, a DA," my mother-in-law continued. "Liz, this might interest you. Jack's company has just won FDA approval for a new drug, and they think it's going to solve this whole opioid crisis." "Well," Jack jumped in, "I wish that were the case, but let's just say it's harder to abuse. It's what's called a tamper-resistant opioid, though addicts often figure out ways to abuse them anyway. And unfortunately, we can't control what people do after they legitimately obtain it from a doctor. We're just trying to make it that much harder for people to get hurt. We just felt it was the right thing to do." After having made a bajillion dollars from their earlier product, I added on his behalf in the privacy of my mind. It had been one of the drivers of the opioid epidemic, thanks to its easily abused formulation and aggressive marketing. But who says that out loud, especially at a wedding and to the bride's father? Not me. Meanwhile, Jack caught Matt's eye, pointed to my stomach, and made a thumbs-up sign, apparently congratulating my husband on a successful knock-up job. I took a deep breath. Unfortunately, my mother-in-law was not done with the topic of prescription meds. She gripped my upper arm, using me as a human hostage for Jack's attention. "Liz works on a lot of cases involving those drugs, don't you, Liz?" "Yes," I said, my earlier desire to be comforted by work talk suddenly obliterated by the concern that I might end up telling off Jack Normand at his daughter's wedding. I'd remembered what I'd heard about this new drug. It was supposed to be harder to abuse, but it was also a stronger and more potent formulation. My contacts at the DEA had also told me that its tamper-resistant feature was a crock and would be defeated easily by anyone determined to get a high. In my opinion, it was a cheap attempt at public redemption. Once again, all I needed to do was keep the mouth shut. Lips together, mouth shut. Jack put his arm around my mother-in-law and tugged her in closer, completely ignoring the opioid angle. "Wonderful, wonderful," he cooed. "I hope you didn't have too much trouble getting here. I'm so touched that everyone came out for my little girl." His eyes glistened. "You know, it's been a tough road with her. I mean, for her." My mother-in-law's eyes lit up. Could Jack be giving her permission to discuss Janie's rocky past? I could tell she was busy formulating a response when my husband busted into the conversation. "Well," Matt said, "we were a bit nervous about the weather forecast, I have to admit, but what the hell, I figured. We've sure waited long enough for Janie to get married." He laughed, then looked around, wondering why no one was laughing with him. "Oh, good heavens, Matt," his mother muttered. I slipped my arm through Matt's and spoke up. "He just means we all knew this guy was the right one for her, and we were the first ones to meet him, weren't we, Matt? So we knew this was coming a long time ago." "Well," said Jack and paused. Matt's mother and I braced ourselves. One never knew how normals would react to Matt's unique brand of wit. Jack looked at my belly again and smiled. "Well," he continued, "we're very touched that you made it under the circumstances, and don't worry about covering up for your husband." He looked kindly toward Matt. "I've known him since he was a little boy. Always said just what he thought unvarnished, and that's a good thing. Fact is, it's true. We're all thrilled she's finally getting married. I'd given up hope that any of them would stick around, and I just hope it's not too late to get a grandkid out of them, if I may be permitted to be blunt myself, before someone changes their mind. I'm also just thrilled that she's finally sober." Matt's mother gasped, then broke out into exaggerated expressions of compassionate congratulations. "She's sober?" I asked. "Sober like how?" I looked at Jack. He hadn't heard me. I looked at Matt. He was busy talking. "So," he was telling Jack, "since we're all okay with me being honest and unvarnished, just to be safe, In case the weather gets worse, you're okay with us crashing here at your place, right, Jack? This place must have some extra rooms, and otherwise you guys live nearby, don't you? Jack smacked Matt's shoulder and laughed. Yes, of course. Of course. In the waning seconds of Jack's attention, my mother-in-law grappled to retain him with talk of the snow and the romance of the storm. I watched as Jack slowly dragged himself away, with the determination and desperation of a man caught in a bog. There was no way to hold him back. Matt and I found ourselves standing blissfully alone. "Having fun yet?" he asked. You know what? My mother-in-law was right. It was romantic. From the warm Tudor interiors of the building, I watched the white mix swirl and streak outside on an indistinct landscape. There were fires burning in the gray stone fireplaces, and I'd managed to sneak a few sips of red wine. I just needed to let it all go now, try to enjoy the event. Matt and I were still parked, unapologetically, on the snack track, though we had moved away from the door. We were now on that magical, invisible path that every server traced from the kitchen doors through the stunning room where everyone had gathered before the ceremony. It was Matt's job to hail the servers, then mine to inspect and accept or pass, depending on the suitability of the food item for my condition. The hors d'oeuvres had reached their peak. We were deep in crab cakes, bacon-wrapped stuffs, and my favorite, satay chicken skewers. My umami senses were on fire. My anxiety was fading. Matt's first cousin, Rob, a 45-year-old surgeon, and his wife, Tess, a stay-at-home mother of twins, were openly conspiring with us to eat as much as possible. In our dark circle of humor, we'd already decided that we'd all be snowed in, and it was best to store reserves in our stomachs in case the staff imposed rations. It was also a smart hedge against a possibly inedible wedding dinner. You know, I bet no one would notice if I just stayed behind and occupied a few floors on the upper floor by myself for a few days, said Tess. What about your kids? I asked. I waved at Fred Krantz, who had appeared behind Tess. He was chatting with two old ladies, or rather, standing between them as they chatted. Tess laughed. Oh, you have no idea, do you? You're still in that phase where you think having kids is going to be great, but let me tell you, there is nothing more appealing to me now than the thought of being totally lost to everyone in a quiet room, just me hiding somewhere in this huge castle with no one screaming, Mommy! Her face contorted in an attempt at a humorous imitation of an annoying child. I'm sure my face contorted with the effort of keeping my mouth shut once again. I had no interest in secluding myself, especially not in an empty mansion rented to rich couples for fantasy weddings, knowing that the marriages would never last as long as the upholstery. More importantly, almost 8 months pregnant after years of failed attempts and heartache, I had no patience for this brand of humor. I still worried about loss every day. That's what happens when you get hopeful, get attached, and then you get hurt over and over again. We all take different things for granted. For me, it had been having children. I had grown up in a house with five other siblings, and I'd assumed I'd inherit my mother's spectacular fertility. Not so. As far as I was concerned, Tess and her cynicism could go shove it. In that moment, I knew our friendship had hit its limit. And with this turn in the conversation, I'd reached my limit. My feet were killing me, and I needed some real food. In fact, it was time for this wedding to proceed, lunch to be lunched, and us to be on our way home. Looking outside once more at the white storm, I wished I could teleport myself into our apartment. Matt, do you think we might have trouble getting home? Maybe I could lay the groundwork for an early departure. He looked outside. We'll be fine. I'm sure it'll die down by the time we get in. Maybe you can check your phone, see what the forecast says? You always complain when I check my phone during events like this, he joked. Listen, we can't leave now anyway, but we'll be fine. I leaned in. When can we leave? Right after lunch. Okay, how about before dessert? I can't have dessert anyway. No, but right after they cut the cake, okay? Matt's eyes bore into mine with a serious expression. I can't believe I'm the one who has to tell you that it would be socially inappropriate to leave earlier. So ironic, I know. Can we renegotiate the departure time if the weather gets worse? Yes. How many hours could that be? I mentally tallied. Ceremony would take 45 minutes, depending on how many symbolic rituals the bride and groom had chosen to include. Lunch would take at least an unfathomable hour and a half, at the very least, since that would be the time for speeches. Would there be dancing before the cake? I reviewed several possible scenarios, none favorable to my dream of an early departure. I comforted myself with the thought that something unpredictable might happen to break up the monotony. Tess made one more attempt at conversation. Did you guys see Janie? I couldn't believe she was letting everyone in earlier. And boy, was she wearing a lot of makeup. Before I could answer, the kitchen door swung open, and a server sailed through, platter in hand. I detected mini pizzas. Matt looked at me. I nodded. He hailed the man, and we raided his tray. I was surprised, Tess continued. I mean, isn't that bad luck to see the bride? Only if it's the groom. Besides, I get it, I said. It's lonely up there. She knows we're all having fun. And she told us months ago that she wanted everyone to come bring her a drink so she could be sure to be nice and wasted for the ceremony. Only way to go, said Tess's husband, as he downed a shot of vodka and plunked it down onto a passing waiter's tray. And then, right behind the waiter, there he popped up again, Fred Krantz. His body was scrunching up and down and jerking sideways as he cut into conversations and whispered in ears and laughed, laughed, laughed. I was impressed. He'd warmed up. He looked like a natural socializer. So dour in court, I thought, but so agile in society. Maybe he really cared about these people. Maybe this was a happy occasion for him. Krantz's current conversational companion was a beautiful brunette, tall, pale, with expressive eyebrows and short hair. She was wearing an indigo sheath dress, soft wool with a resplendent black leather belt. The tone and texture of the dress and belt were inviting to the touch, new, expensive, deep, and distinct. What could they possibly be discussing? I couldn't resist and excuse myself from the group. At first, I circled them slowly like a pregnant barracuda, and eventually just lingered on the periphery of their conversation. One calculated small trip, whoops, I'm so sorry, and I was in, as Krantz instinctively gripped my arm to prevent me from falling. Thank you so much, I said. It's so tricky to be in heels when my center of gravity is off. I smiled expectantly at Krantz and his companion waiting to be introduced. Dr. Hendricks, this is Ms. Acorn, I said, saving Krantz. Lise Acorn, lovely to meet you. Hello, she said with a cautious smile. Are you also a friend of the bride's mother, I asked? Yes, well, not quite. I'm one of Jack's colleagues. Dr. Hendricks is director of pain management at New York Hospital, said Krantz. And as we were just discussing, a member of the FDA's Advisory Committee on Anesthetic and Analgesic Drug Products. What? How was he so quick with the terminology? Did Krantz and I share an interest in opioid regulation? I reappraised the man. He was horribly dressed, but perhaps more interesting than I had expected. Fascinating, I said. Did you have to recuse yourself on Reliva, Mr. Norman's new product? I didn't need Krantz's sharp look to know I had goofed. Dr. Hendricks pretended she hadn't heard me and leaned down from her height and beauty to examine my insolent face more closely. I tried to fix my mistake. That must be fascinating work, I meant. Just then, a photographer popped into our circle wielding a giant camera, apparently unable to see the gaping, jagged hole I had just blasted into an otherwise charming moment. May I? Asked the photographer, raising the lens. Dr. Hendricks froze. I'm so sorry, she said. I have to find the powder room. Exit stage left, she went, and I didn't linger either. With an apologetic glance to Krantz and the photographer, I hustled back to the safe cluster of Matt, Rob, and Tess. Four servers and three hot appetizers later, white-clad Waveney staff opened the double doors into the ceremony room. Guests whooshed in with a collective anxiety about securing the best seats. For me, this was glorious, the beginning of the end of being on my feet. I was one step closer to lunch, dances, cake, and the heavenly homeward journey. It almost seemed like fun now, the idea of donning our coats and boots, our future slog to the car, gossiping all the way home in snow traffic, moving further and further away from my gaffes. And so we sat and sat. I moved my buttocks to the left and then to the right, and painstakingly crossed my legs one way, then the other, We had been among the last to get in and were stuck in the back of the room without any view of the bridal canopy. I caught a few glances of Dr. Hendricks seated near the front, head lowered, periodically turning toward the person to her left or right with a smile and a few words. Krantz was standing behind us, behind everyone. I think his wife had saved him a seat, as I could see her gesturing to him, but he waved her off. Perhaps he couldn't be bothered to sit still. I turned my attention from the guests to the staff and got a feeling that something was wrong. They looked distracted and confused, and a couple of them were holding their earbuds in more tightly. I looked at Krantz, his eyes locked on mine for just a second. I remembered our first trial together. The judge had messed up his instructions to the deliberating jury, and we'd both known immediately that it would be a mistrial. Krantz had given me that same look. "Something's going to happen," he was telling me. "Get ready." I excused myself and walked out through the double doors into the foyer. There was a hush as a group of waiters saw me and stopped chattering. I heard fast footsteps in the hallway. There was something wrong, something happening, something brewing. Someone spoke right into my ear. "Seems like someone got cold feet." I turned, startled. It was Krantz. He looked at my belly. "Gives you a good excuse to get up and leave the room whenever you want to, doesn't it?" "I think something happened." "Me too, but what makes you think it's any of your business?" I blushed, then got angry. "Is it any more your business than mine? What kind of question is that?" He tapped my shoulder. Okay. Don't get worked up. You and I probably have the same kind of radar." Jack Normand ran into the foyer. He looked frantically left and right. My whole body went cold. Jack saw us and skidded to a stop. "A doctor. We need a doctor. Fred, please. We don't have much time. A doctor and maybe the police, but EMTs, 911, whatever." Fred looked at me. "Lise will call 911. I'll find a doctor, but you need to tell us." Jack swayed. I caught his arm. "Mr. Normand, Jack, do you want to sit down?" "No, I have to go back. Tell them she's unconscious. Foam in her mouth. I have to go back. What if my little girl..." He choked back a sob and ran back toward the hallway. I heard his footsteps pound up the stairs. I pulled my phone out of my purse and dialed 911. Fred walked up to the waiters and asked one of them, a tall, steady-looking woman, if she could ask and find out if any of the staff had EMT training, and if so, to send them upstairs to the bridal suite immediately. He then ducked into the ceremony room. The phone call was not one of my best moments. 911 operator, what is your emergency? Possible overdose at Waveney Castle. Is the victim conscious? Unconscious. Breathing? I don't know. I'm not with her. Where are you? Waveney Castle. Wave a what? Waveney Castle, New Canaan. What's the address? I don't know if there's an address. It's just Waveney Castle. Ma'am, without an address, I can't dispatch anyone over to you. Jesus, can you just send someone quickly? She's foaming at the mouth, unconscious. It's her wedding, for God's sake. Ma'am, calm down. I need to enter an address. I almost threw the phone down. Hold on, okay? Hold on. I waved over a waitress. What's the address here? Oh my God, I have no idea. Can you please find out? Hurry. The operator's voice was tight. Ma'am, you're going to have to speak up and tell me what's going on. You said the victim is unconscious. I need you to tell me what's going on. Hang on, I said, as I was already making my way down the hall and up the stairs as quickly as I could. I was breathing too heavily to speak. Hang on, I'm on my way there. I'm sorry, I'm out of breath. Ma'am, did you say Waveney Castle? Is that 677 South Avenue, Sierra Oscar Uniform Tango Hotel, South Avenue in New Canaan? Yes, that must be it. Yes, please just send an ambulance urgently. I caught my breath and rapped on the carved door of the bridal suite. There was a white bouquet of tuberose hanging off the doorknob by a pale pink ribbon. The flowers shook as I pounded on the door with greater force. I felt bad to be intruding, but Jack himself had asked me to make this call. It was legitimate for me to bust in, right? The door opened. The sea of pale-faced bridal party members parted, and I saw Jack's head turning toward the door. "Who the hell is it?" he shouted. "Jack," I said, "I'm on the phone with 911 like you asked. They need to know her condition. They can talk you through CPR while we wait for the ambulance." He'd already turned his head away. "We've already got them on the phone in here." As the door slammed, I caught a glimpse of Janie's tan arm on the floor, her hand limp and outstretched, and one of her feet tangled up in the white lace of her wedding dress. Just a few hours earlier, I'd seen her push her feet into those shoes. I'd heard her laugh. This was not what I had expected. I almost fell on my way down the stairs. A woman in a blue pantsuit ran past me toward the bridal suite. Matt was waiting at the bottom with Fred Krantz. There's a radiologist. That's all we got. She's on her way up. I think I saw her. A thought occurred to me. Wait, what about Dr. Hendricks? Where is she? Fred shrugged and looked around. I couldn't find her. No one knows. Hopefully she'll turn up, or maybe she's up there already. I turned to Matt and couldn't stop my tears. Matt, maybe you want to be here for your family, but can we please go? I can't stay here. They don't need us to be here, please. He didn't even hesitate. You got it, kid. I didn't know if this was just a manifestation of his chronic, disordered emotions and limited social empathy, but I didn't give a damn. If it meant all he cared about right now was me and my well-being, he was my hero. He took hold of my shoulder and pulled me in. Nothing we can do anyway, you're right. This isn't about us. He looked at Fred. Need a ride? Fred looked at me, then at Matt, with an expression of genuine surprise. No, I'm staying. I'm not leaving till I know she's okay. Maybe he realized he was making us feel bad. He seemed to catch himself. He seemed like he was about to say something. But then he stopped himself and walked away without another word. Matt went to alert his parents as I got our coats. No way I was participating in that conversation. I knew we couldn't drag Matt's mother out of there. She was living a real-life drama. She'd never allow anyone to cut it short. And I guess she also cared about Janie. Though in my mind, if you truly cared, you'd leave the family alone in this case. 40 minutes later, we were barely past Stamford, caught in a trail of cars and a whirlwind of snow. The phone rang, and my mother-in-law's voice blared over the Bluetooth speakers. I didn't have time to turn down the volume before she screamed out the words, "She's dead, Maddie, she's dead!" I threw my hands over my ears and closed my eyes, but couldn't get away from it. Not the sobbing, not the questions, not the closed confinement of the car, not the slow unfolding of a family tragedy, not the image in my mind. I made darkness over my eyes with my hands, but I could still see Janie's outstretched hand. The baby came early, just 3 weeks later. It occurred to me that it was because of what happened to Janie, the shock, the emotions. But I managed to push it all out of my mind during the 18 hours of labor that preceded the delivery and the first few hours that followed. I then found myself sitting up in my hospital bed, holding my newborn, running my finger across her tiny, pruny palm, when I thought of Janie's hand again, limp, lifeless, outstretched. I imagined running my finger across the skin of Janie's palm, which must have held some lingering warmth, but also the waxy weight of recent death. I shoved my daughter's hand under her blanket and dropped my head back against the pillows. When would it go away? Or maybe I should think about these things. There was birth and there was death. Sometimes the anticipated order of death was disrupted. I knew that only too well from my job. In a flash, I decided that if my daughter died, I would kill myself, and if anyone killed my daughter, I would kill them. That's how central she was to my life now. These were clear, direct conclusions, and I felt no shame at thinking these things, no concern at my own state of mind. I was just being honest with myself. I was finally being myself. Optimists don't become prosecutors. It was a relief in a way to just be able to think what I wanted, see life for what it was, to see its best and contemplate its worst. This clarity, this honest thinking was an expression of love for my new daughter. I looked down at my baby. Was she hungry? Because I could feed her. It was within my power to satisfy almost all of her needs. 24 hours later, I was in the same position, sitting up in bed with my baby in my arms, contemplating the miracle of her existence. She'd been taken out of the room for a checkup. I had slept a few hours. We had received a few visitors, but time felt like it largely stood still in the maternity ward. We were in the sweet spot of life, the two of us in our sterile hospital gowns and blankets, one big and one little, codependent and connected, safe and secluded. I felt like we could stay this way forever. This was the moment I would choose to live in forever. There was a knock on the door. I didn't recognize this doctor. He wasn't wearing a white coat. "Yes?" I asked. The man waved. "How are you?" I'm sorry, I said. You are... The man looked startled and his face changed. I thought I recognized him, but it didn't make sense. The light from the window hit his skin. It was dry, almost crumpled. My lungs suddenly felt empty. Why was he here? Fred? May I? He said, pointing at a chair. I couldn't answer. The chair's metal legs grated along the floor as he pulled it toward the bed. I pulled my baby's blanket a little further up over her ears and held her tight. He gestured toward the bundle in my arms. Congratulations. Thank you. I don't mean to be rude, but what are you doing here? How did you get in? He shrugged and looked at the door. I'm not sure myself, to be honest. Which one? What? You're not sure why you're here, or you're not sure why you got in? Made me angry that I needed to be questioning him. He was reminding me of too many things outside this room. Cross-examinations, cases, courts, and Janie. Fred looked straight into my eyes. I need to say something to you. I waited. He dipped his hand into his right jacket pocket and fumbled around. It came out empty. He did the same with the left. Empty. He twisted on himself to pull up the back of his jacket and reach into one, then the other back pants pocket. He pulled out a folded piece of newsprint. I'm going to read you something. He unfolded the paper. He glanced up at me. He switched his eyes down to the piece of paper. The hardest part about being a prosecutor is remembering that it's a job and knowing that we don't have the tools or laws to find a culprit for every crime. Sometimes a case will affect you personally, or you might feel frustrated by the inability to help. The opioid epidemic is a good example of that for me. I recently had a case where a young woman died of an overdose, but her body wasn't found until 2 days later. When the police finally arrived, they discovered the victim's 8-month-old baby crawling around her mom's dead body, crying its heart out. We couldn't trace the pills back to a dealer or doctor, and even if we could have, there was no guarantee we could have held anyone responsible for this death. Some might say only the addicts are responsible. I can't believe that when we have so many people dying all around us and so many people are making so much money from selling these pills. But ultimately, my duty as a prosecutor is to apply the laws fairly as they are. All the leftover feelings we have about the law or the cases, we just have to set them aside and move on. He paused, as though he were reading it again, silently to himself. He looked up at me, then crumpled up the piece of paper, tossed it into the garbage can in the corner. It arced smoothly and went right in. Slam dunk, I said. I'm not so sure about that. He crossed his arms. I don't really know how to say this. There's nothing I can do with what I know or what I think I know. He looked up at the ceiling. Well, there are a few things I do know, so I guess I should start with those. He looked at my baby, then my face. You shouldn't be a prosecutor. I'm not saying you're not good at it. I'm not saying there are any human beings necessarily perfect enough to enforce the laws against others, but you can't do it anymore. You took a life, in some way, or you played a not insignificant role in ending a life. At least I think you did. And I think you did. Depending on how it happened, maybe it wasn't a crime in itself. I mean, maybe you just didn't stop her, even though you knew. I didn't know she'd gotten sober. Fred's voice hardened and his eyes narrowed. He leaned forward and lowered his voice, sending his sharp whisper right into my ear. I don't think you should say anything at all. Do me a favor. Don't say another word. He paused, leaned back, and glared at me again. Not another word. He slapped his palms onto his thighs. You knew enough. You were up there. You've got your socially inept husband, who's just perfect because he's so honest, but he's also a total space cadet, so the chances of him noticing were, well, I'm sure you knew how to do it, how to focus him somewhere else. Everyone knew she was joking about getting wasted. He half closed his eyes momentarily and shook his head. At least you young people knew. We only knew later. Her poor mother had no idea, or she would have told people about the treatment program. He stopped. Well, that's another story. He looked up at me again. I didn't know how much more of this I could take. Though it occurs to me, What did her mother tell people about Janie? What did she tell Matt's mother? How much did you know? I'm thinking about how much I heard about you from them at the wedding, your miscarriages, your fertility treatments. He stared at me. I looked down at my baby and wished she weren't asleep so that I could keep busy with her. You know, the tox screen came back last week. It revealed alcohol, Xanax, and fentanyl. I'd been thinking the Xanax was laced, given the amounts and proportions, and surprisingly there was not much fentanyl, but since she'd been cleaning the two drugs, he interlaced his hands and pumped them together. Worked in combination to decrease heart function, so it wouldn't have taken that much, but still, you needed to get your hands on some of that to give it to her. I don't know how you... He dropped his hands, started wiping them up and down on his pants leg again, then cocked his head to the side. But now, what if... Maybe this is crazy, but what if... I know she was doing fertility shots, but what if you knew that? What if you helped her that day? Maybe she said, "Oh, I'm so nervous, I can't do it," he said in a mock high-pitched voice. And then, "Oh, let me help you." What if you drew fentanyl out of a patch? What if you gave her the injection? We know she did the injection not long before she died, but since she'd used up her fertility meds for the day, we didn't think... But how would you have gotten rid of the patch afterward? How could you have... He stared at me. I thought about Janie's clammy hands fumbling with her injection kit and the way she looked up at me with relief. I thought about my own relief at not having had to figure out how to slap the patch on her without her noticing. My inspiration in distracting Matt toward the bar while I mixed her meds and quickly drew some gel out of the fentanyl patch. The familiar tap-tap on the syringe, the warm pinch of her tummy skin, the feeling of letting go, that feeling of, here goes, as I pressed the plunger, that feeling of not wanting to kill her, but having felt like someone deserved a lesson, some confusion, maybe a mild scare at worst. I cleared my throat. Am I allowed to say something? No. He stood up, pushed back his chair. You are... Your... I mean... He opened his hands, palms up, in a gesture of wonderment. What am I supposed to do? I have nothing. Nothing except what you said in that interview in my gut. And it happened that I'd heard about that case of that woman with her baby because it was handled by someone at the medical examiner's office, who, as it turned out, did a sloppy job of handling evidence, okay, more than sloppy, and was in fact turning around and selling drugs that were recovered at overdose scenes. So given the right set of circumstances, you might have been able to get yourself something. That person is now my client, which is how I know, and which is one of the reasons why... He put his hands out in front of him, one wrist crossed over the other. It's tricky. I could ask. I could follow up. But it's tricky. And I don't have anything else, so there's that. And there were a lot of people up there with her that day, and there's the Xanax. Where did that come from? And your family. What am I supposed to do, except tell you to think about your life and ask for your resignation on behalf of the people of the state of New York? Though frankly, if it's what I'm thinking it is now, it's so much worse than I thought. So much worse. Maybe I'm the one committing a crime right now, but because I came here, something else has happened too as a result, and that is I've got her, he pointed to my baby, to think about, not just the other girl. He walked to the door. You're just an old man, I said. Fred Krantz looked tired. Let me tell you something. When they grow up, however bad they've been, they still feel to the parents like she feels to you now. Like this. He crossed his arms over his chest and hugged himself. Head down, eyes closed. Always. He left. And I never saw him again.
Father of the Corpse is copyrighted by Cecilia Fulton. Music for the podcast entitled Cobwebbed was obtained from purpleplanet.com. Mixing for the podcast was done by Jackie Sherbo. You can subscribe to Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine, where you'll find more stories like this one by visiting our website at www.ellerycreenmysterymagazine.com.